National Fishermen and Pacific Marine Expo are proud supporters of the Galley Stories podcast, as we make similar efforts to highlight the people and topics that define commercial fishing. You can see what that looks like in print and online all year long, as well as every November in Seattle when this community comes together at PME. Check out nationalfisherman.com and pacificmarineexpo.com to learn more.
Hello and welcome to Galley Stories, stories of the Bering Sea and beyond, hosted by Mark Kaler. My name is Penka Jane, podcast deckhand and longtime listener. We'd thank you to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Here's today's catch.
Hey guys, this episode is brought to you by Alaska Brewing Company out of Juneau, Alaska. Go check out their new Wild Ness beer, launched on March 1st. Any place that you got a good retailer near you or your favorite watering hole. Here we go. Hello guys, welcome back to another installment of Galley Stories, Stories of the Bering Sea and Beyond. I am your host, Mark Kaler. Today we have captain and vessel owner, Conrad Urie, with us today. How about I stumbled over that there, Conrad? And welcome, Conrad. How are you?
I am fine.
Good, thank good. We'll just dive right into with where you were born and what got you into the fishing industry, and when.
Okay, I was born in Ballard, Washington. In 1934, and I was in the fishing industry probably from day one, since my father was already fishing, and it was how it went, basically, in those days. So I didn't go fishing, you know. My first trip was in 1946. Okay, my first trip, and it was tuna fishing down off of Oregon, basically, and Washington. And I was seasick as a dog. It was terrible. First time out there, was only 10 years, 11 years old, whatever it was. And but it was fun. I was not seasick when I was up on deck. It's only when, because we had forecastle down below, and the forecastle is where the crew slept. And in those boats, it was down in the hold, basically, in the head of the engine room in the bow. So.
What was the name of that vessel? And was it a wooden vessel?
Wooden vessel, the Christine. He doesn't have a picture of it here. And it was built by Breskovich in Tacoma in 1945, right when the war ended. So, and then I couldn't go fishing before 46, as my mother wouldn't let me go while the war was on. So, but it was fun. I loved it. We were bait fishing. And where you have racks around the stern of the vessel, three quarters of it anyway, from the stern and around one side. And then you stand in the rack with the pole, maybe people have seen them, the Portuguese and the Italians on those big seiners, they're pole fishing. Well, so you stood in the rack outside the actual hull. I wasn't allowed to do that, I could only stay inside and fish, but that's okay, I got fish too. So. But that was fun. And then
was that just slinging them right on? They bit that fast, and you were just on a bait ball or something.
And slinging aboard, and of course, as soon as you got it up here, you just gave a little slack, and the hook. As soon as you got it up to your shoulder, the fish, you know, you slack on the line, and the fish fell right off. So it was, but it was real fun. It was a sport fishing, really.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like it.
And
especially for an 11-year-old.
Oh yeah, no, it was. Yeah, of course. It was a start. I wasn't allowed to go except in the summertime, as long as I was in school. So I fished every summer after that with my dad. So
did your dad continue to fish during the war?
Yes, they were fishing. He came over here from Norway in 1926, and got a job fishing. That's what he knew. And by 1930, he owned a part of a boat, and fished that all during the war. And then, right when the war was ending, then they saw it was ending. They ordered a new boat, and that was the Christine. So, a great boat, wonderful sea boat, pretty boat, they said, and it was. And then from then on, when the war ended, but before the war ended, before the war ended, prices for fish were great. on the Christine, we had 8 guys. And then as things started to settle down after the war, then we got all these imports from Asia, from Europe, and the price went straight down. So where we had always been 8 guys, eventually we were down to 3 because the prices were so poor. And 3 cents a pound, sometimes less. And then also they gave you a shopping list of what they could sell, because the canneries here weren't doing that well either with all the imports. So they gave you a shopping list, so much codfish, so much lake cod, so much sole, flounder, you know, halibut or whatever. When we were fishing halibut, then it was just halibut. But anyway, when we were trawling, on bottom trawling, we delivered a Duke's mixture about every 10 days. And we were 3 guys, and it was 100,000. Christine packed 100,000 pounds, filled it up, on slow fishing down here, we would take 10 days, 12 days, fill it up. So that's how that worked out. That went fine. Then
on that vessel, how were you keeping the fish cold, or what were you doing to treat the fish?
All the fish was bled, and all the fish was iced, and all the fish were laid head to tail. They were just thrown in a bin and throw ice on it. Every fish was laid head to tail until you had a layer, and iced a layer. When we were tuna fishing, I should maybe go back on that, a good question. There we iced the fish same way, and we didn't bleed them there, we just iced them. And then we salted the ice, and that got a real hard layer of ice in there because we were out in 60 degree water and 70 degree temperatures and things. We didn't have refrigeration in the Christine in those days. So that's how we kept the fish. And but when we were during the war and afterwards, and I didn't fish in the war, I wasn't allowed, but then we bled the fish, dressed the fish, including the flounders. We dressed all the flounders too, and iced them. Like I said, we iced them, laid everything in there, iced. And that, as time went by, we went. We quit tuna fishing. Tuna disappeared. So we went. They disappeared for a number of years. Then they came back again. Fish do that, come and go. So we put trawl gear on and went trawling for bottom fish. I can't give you a whole life history here, but there wasn't hardly any money.
Love
it was
that.
At 3
Love
cents
that.
A pound, you know, that isn't much money. And we were 3 guys, and we were family. To start with, it was my uncle and myself and one other guy, and then when my younger brother was old enough, he came, and then we were the 3 aboard. And that stayed that way for many years. I don't think we were more than, we got up to 4 people in the early 60s. But then I got drafted in 1957. And so I was gone for 2 years. I don't know, but they kept fishing. They got another guy to come aboard. And then when I came back, we managed to get it up to 4 guys. But we still didn't get the prices up much. It went up a quarter. The prices went up a quarter of a cent a year. That was it. And we had to strike for that quarter cent. Then I went halibut fishing. I went back to trawling with my uncle, and then I wanted to see how it was to be halibut fishing. So I went halibut fishing for a season. That was okay. It was fun. I didn't see anything very hard about it, but it was okay.
Is that here off the coast still, or
no, up in Alaska? Off of Kodiak.
Okay,
around Kodiak.
Was that your first trip up to Alaska?
No, I was up in Alaska in 1954, packing salmon out of Kodiak, and then I was up in Alaska before I got drafted in '57. I fished a season of salmon up in southeastern, with Jimmy Maloney on the Mildred. Was a boat. So that was great. That was, you know, that's another thing. That's kind of like tuna fishing. It's kind of party fishing, practically. It's not exactly anything that's going to kill you. So then I went halibut fishing, and I liked that, but we had our own boat. I just wanted to learn how to do it, and I wanted to learn how to salmon seine, so that's why I did that. And so went halibut fishing. Then we went home back on the boat, Christine, and we went back dragging again. And we were, for two, three years there, we were delivering, on that little boat, we were delivering 2 million pounds a year. We left on the 1st of January, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we tied up the 13th of December. In those days, there was no quota, and so you could fish year-round, which we did, and you could shift fisheries also. So we fished from off of Washington, Vancouver Island, all the way up to Dixon Entrance, depending on...
Can you talk us through, from January 1 to December 13th, can you talk us through that season?
Yeah, well, it's...
Lay it out for us.
I'll give you the hard ones. I know we were on some of these. We were only three guys too. So we left. 8 o'clock in the morning, and I told the crew, "You're here at 8 o'clock, or you're not having a job. And we don't wait. I haven't got time, and you know that we only have a year to fish." So we fished. So we left, and if everything went well, weather was fairly decent, we would fish 10 days, come back to Seattle and unload. We had to fill the boat up ourselves, and then we had to unload it ourselves, and then we had to wash down a fish hole and sanitize that before we could go off the boat, and then we hauled the gear off, overhauled all the gear, took groceries the next day, and ice, and left. So we were home 3 days between trips, and then we left. So that we did over and over. Some of the only rest you got, if you want to call it rest, was when it was blowing so much we couldn't fish. It was just jogging, but everybody was—they didn't mind that, so because when you're fishing, and we in those days, since we were only three guys, we were trying it. We fished to start with, three guys, 19 hours a day. Then when we got a fourth guy, then we fished around the clock, 24 hours a day. But it was the same. Went up the inside channel, inside passage, went out the. In Hackett Strait lots, fished for 3 days, filled the boat up, went home. So that was really good fishing, and even though by that time the price had got up to a nickel a pound. So we were making a little money, not much take home. So we did all the work on the boat ourselves. We painted it, we overhauled the engine every year, made our own nets to start with, and finally we could. Because you didn't have money to buy a net, so we made our own. And finally we were able to buy a net, and that helped. But it was also, it was just part of fishing. You know, in those days, you did everything yourself. You didn't run to the cat or the engineer, you know, the engine companies or anybody, you know. Only if it was some electronics our electronics consisted of a fathometer and a radio, a direction finder, and an old autopilot, chain-driven autopilot. That was our electronics, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. But it got us to and from, and nobody got the worse for wear. Everybody learned to read a chart, everybody learned to read a compass, because everybody had to stand and watch it one side or the other.
So if there's only three of you on the boat, you were driving the boat?
Yeah.
And then the other two were on deck most of the time?
Yeah, and when we were trawling, on a known bottom, then I went out and helped on the deck too, and then I cooked, and then I was engineer, so I had enough to do besides helping the guys.
How old were you when you started running the family boat? When you were the one in charge?
62, 63. Well, how old was I?
Yeah, how old were you?
Oh gosh,
first time you got the keys.
I would say that I was. Let's see. I was 30 years old.
Okay.
You know, and I probably would have been running it early, but there was no money. And my uncle had been with my dad.
Family, was a part family of business. Dad. Everybody's got to have their part.
So,
right.
Right. So he was, but you know, I was up, I took a lot of the tow, especially because he was getting older also. So I took a lot of tow, especially at night. And, so then we, then I got, it got to be, we couldn't do that forever, you know, go leave here, it's a day and a half to the fishing grounds, 3 days fishing, or a day and a half home. You're home 3 days, and you leave and do the same thing. So you get 3 trips a month. But, you know, by the time the year's over, you're wore out. So, and as I said, the only time we had time off was if it was bad weather, and then we got a, if we could find a harbor, we ducked into one, and everybody got a good sleep and a rest and waited for the weather to go down. Then I decided in 1968 that this wasn't going to work, and so I built with my uncle and my at the time brother-in-law, we built a crab boat, the Sea View. He just showed you the picture of it there, and everybody thought it was kind of weird because we'd never been crab fishing. But I kind of told him, you know, if you can catch fish, you can catch any fish. So it's not exactly science, you know. But so we built that boat, and we went up. We left in November of 1969, and went to Adak, and it was poor fishing, no crab. And then we got home, and went home, and there was a chip in there. Had a chip in a tooth in the gearbox. We had to go back to Seattle and have that fixed.
All the way back from Adak.
Yeah. So got that fixed, went back up, and then, of course, we waited till, and then there was no fishing in the summer because nobody, you know, everybody said there was no crab in the summer, so nobody fished it. That was not true, of course. We found out later. But so we went up the next year, and that went well, better. We were getting used to the fishery. Went up, and then of course decided to build another boat because the other, my partner, he wanted his own boat. So okay, we built a new boat, the Rainier, which I was running, he was running Seaview. And when the Rainier, I had my wife and two kids with me. One boy was 9 and the other was 5 or 4. He turned 5 up in the Bering Sea. And my wife was with the whole time. She cooked, she spoiled the crew. She cooked too good and she baked too much for them, so that she was forever, they weren't getting skinny, I can tell you that.
And how many guys were on, did you have on the crew then?
Four guys.
Still 4 guys.
Yeah.
And what about your 9-year-old?
No, they were hard. But then, you know, it changed. We went out to Adak again and there was no crab. In 72, there was no crab either. So we went, so then it was, in those winters it was cold. Bering Sea froze over. In 70, 71, 69, 70, 71, 72, the Bering Sea froze over every year. But we came out of Adak and we hadn't made any money, so I told the crew, well, we're going to go up into Bering Sea because it's open. And I had talked to a guy that was fishing up out of Port Moeller, and he said I should maybe take a trip up. So we went, we banged through the ice to get up there. And you find out what a tin can or steel boat is in the ice. And we got 3 full loads out of there. And it was an interesting occurrence because when we got up there, then Unice, which had they were the only ones buying, then the guy that had it was running Unice, he came on a fish cannery in Dutch Harbor. He came on the radio and said, I'm shutting down the plant, going home, you guys got to find somewhere else to sell your crap. So, and it was really cold. It was so cold when we were laying up, when we were fishing, when we were just laying drifting in the ice, when the boat rolled just in its flat cogs like this rug, when the boat rolled just a little bit, you know, it was squeak, 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 because you're rolling in ice, and that's how stiff the water was. If it had stopped squeaking, we would have been stuck. So I had one guy that he slept on a galley table because he didn't like that sound next to his ear in the bunk. So we had a watchman out there and it went fine, but it was really something, flat calm, and there was that, the water temperature was about 30 degrees or less, 29, 30 degrees. Fishing was fantastic. We got a load in, about 5 days. We got 140,000 pounds of crab. Chopped our way all the way to Kodiak. Every 2 hours, we had to stop and chop ice.
Now, this is all before, like, the King Coiler, too.
Oh, yeah. This is all hand coiling.
Can you explain that to our listeners a little bit?
Well, anyway, before we became modern and mechanized, when we were hauling gear, you had to coil by hand. So you had to grab the line, pull it in, make a circle as you laid it down on the deck and stack it up till you had it all coiled nicely, because you were going to have to set it again. It had to be coiled perfectly, really, because if you set it and there was a snarl in it, you lost the pot and you lost everything else. Couldn't afford that.
A lot like a garden hose, just
yes, perfectly. And then, of course, science got in there, and when they came up with a coiler, and that was great because we were fishing deeper and deeper, really deep. But we chopped ice. We did that three times in a row, and three good trips. And when we came to Kodiak, we delivered to Bix Bonney in Kodiak, and so he offered us 50 cents a pound, which was astronomical. But he said, you got to wait. He was supposed to unload 8 in the morning. So we got up there. So that was fine because we had to chop ice anyway. So he said, you got to wait till this evening and we'll unload you. So then he came aboard in the evening. He said, well, I said, I can't unload you. Yes, I'm going to do it in the morning, but I'll give you another nickel. So, okay, that's fine. We're making money laying at the dock. So then in the morning he comes out and he tells us again, well, he says, I'm behind. I can't take you now. I'll have to wait till noon and then we'll give you another nickel. Well, now we're up to 60 cents. We're making money. And so that went great. So we got 3 cents, three trips at 60 cents a pound, about 140,000.
All from the Bering Sea and back over to Kodiak.
All from the Bering Sea to Kodiak. And that's a long ride, and it's a long ride when you got to chop ice in those winters. They were tough winters, not like now. There's some ice in the Bering Sea, but it's nothing like those years. Chop ice every 2 hours, and it's blowing like hell on the Pacific side. Whatever. Anyway, that was quite the adventure. Quite the adventure.
What kind of dead loss would you see on a trip like that?
None.
Really?
No, we didn't see dead loss. We couldn't sell, the crab. We didn't want dead loss, so we didn't. We watched the crab. You didn't just throw everything in the hole. We had to measure everything. You had to measure every crab. Mm-hmm. So 140,000 pounds, you're measuring every single crab. Later in the year, when things changed again, that was a great season, probably the best season I ever had. Then, after that, everybody figured out the crab were up there in the summertime too, because we went back up in the summer. When we were through with the ice, went home, came back, went up there in the summer, and of course the crab were still there. So I got about, I don't know, 5-6 trips before anybody found me up there. And after that, it was a circus. The whole fleet was up there. It was okay. There was enough crab to take care of everybody and it helped everybody out, really.
So that first season up there, when you banged out those three trips and got 60 cents a pound, did that pay your boat off?
Oh, yeah. So, but anyway, it was interesting. It was only five of us fishing up because everybody else went home. They didn't want to go up and fish in ice. And we didn't have a choice either. We had to have some money. You know, we couldn't send everybody home with no money. So we went up there, and luckily enough, there was crab there. And I told one or two other guys, I really called them in Dutch Harbor and told them, you better come up and take a look at this. And so they did, and they all did extremely well.
What species were you getting?
King crab.
King crab, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was that. Then we fished crab, and there never was any more crab in ADAC. Disappeared. The last trip we got out of ADAC of king crab, you were mentioning Bart Eaton the other day. Bart Eaton was there with us at that time. He was still fishing. And we ended up, 10 of us, fishing down in 340 fathoms for king crab up there. And full pots, but we ran out of line. We could only have enough line aboard with us, and there was no stores up there, no place to get gear. So we were down to 10 pots, but every pot was full when you hauled it up. And they were still walking deeper as we followed them all the way from 5 fathoms and by Cape Idaloog and all the way down past Cape Shaw and continued on out to the pretty much the northwest. And that was that. But they've never found them back that I've ever heard of. I know they tagged lots of crab out there. I don't think they got many tags back, maybe one. Bart Eaton got one, as I recall.
Yeah, I saw him this morning. He said to tell you hello.
No, okay. So anyway, that's the last time I fished alongside of Bart when he was out there. So Then crabbing kind of cut down a little bit. So we five of us decided to get in the trawl, factory trawl business. So we bought a factory trawler that one of two that had built in America, been built in America in the 60s, was laying in Norfolk, the Seafreeze Atlantic we bought, and completely overhauled it and went out for codfish, trawling for codfish. And by the way, the Atlantic, Seafreeze Atlantic, we changed the name. But
what'd you name it?
Lucian Trawler. I can't remember. But anyway, Arctic Trawler, we named it. And then we, so the first trip, we left in, the boat went up in 1980 left, took over a year to overhaul it. We left, I stayed home, and then two other guys went up. It didn't do so well, so then I went up, and one of the fellows stayed, a Norwegian fellow, stayed, who was a partner. Eric Breivik, he had his own boat Atlantic in Norway, and he came over here and invested with us. Nice guy, good, great fisherman. And we went up there, I went up and joined him, and then I told him we ought to go to Seguin Pass, which is halfway out there, a little more out towards Adak. And we had an old green crew. We had eight Norwegians aboard that had come over with him and had green cards that were all with. So we were, and then myself. And so then it was all green American crew, 66 people. Went out there and found fish right away. Big fishing, full factory every day. So from no trip to a really, I think we delivered 700 tons of fillet codfish, codfish fillets. And after that, we went really well. Every time we went back to the same place. And when that did peter out some, then we went up in the Bering Sea, and lots of codfish in the Bering Sea too. So that went well for a number of years. And but in the meantime, with these partners, we had acquired a couple of crab catcher processors, and we were catching and processing crab. And then, as I said before, when the fishery went down, the crab fishery went down some, and it wasn't so rosy. That's when we got into the Arctic trawler, and that boat's still around, still solid as a rock, built on the East Coast. They built two of them. They couldn't get them to work on the East Coast, either one of them. They couldn't keep crew. Americans on the East Coast, they were all union guys, and they wouldn't go. We made 2-3-4 month trips gone from home to fill that thing up with 2,000 tons of codfish fillets. That's a lot of fish. And they have one of back there. The crew members wanted to go home, so they would sabotage the boats, throw a wrench. It was decent electric, so they would throw a wrench or some steel into the armature. You know, there went that engine, and you had to have your engines because it was all diesel electric. And they went to Norway and tried to get a crew and fish, and that didn't work. And then they got a bunch of Portuguese over, that didn't work. And those Portuguese who were there, they came out west. When they tied that boat up that time, they came west and went into the drag fleet, the little drag fleet we had here. They were really good fishermen, and they did really well, and the nicest guys. Some of their children are still fishing here, you know, their grandchildren, and married here and have children. The Norwegians, some of the Norwegians married here and are still here. But they're all retired. I remember when they came aboard, they were 20 years old. Well, that's 40 years ago, 45 years, that's a long time ago. So they're all retiring now, and I have, not often, but sometimes someone will walk up and say, "You remember me from the Arctic Trawler?" You know, I said, it's 40 years ago, you know. So kind of difficult to recognize somebody when they came aboard at 20 and now they're 65. There is a few few changes.
So in the course of starting in 1946, essentially, to now, and here in Ballard especially, Ballard being known as a very, very historical fishing area, you know, here in Seattle, very Norwegian fishing area, you've seen it change a lot over the years.
Oh, yeah.
Can you describe some of those changes, not just with Ballard, but with the industry?
Well, the industry is all, it's like any other industry. It has its ups and downs. And the ups and downs in the fishing industry is the fish. When there's a lot of fish, more people come in. When there's not much fish, people leave. And but now, as we got all of this fancy new equipment, sonar and all this fish finding equipment and the new gear that we have or had, it's pretty hard to go out and not find fish someplace. It's a big ocean up there. But then they came along, and the biggest thing they did and over this time, which really has diminished the size of the fishing industry, they went in with a quota system on catch. And so you had to have fished in a certain time period or you didn't get a quota. No quota, no boat. If you didn't get a quota, you had to get rid of your boat somewhere else, sell it, and you couldn't sell it into anything else in Alaska except to go salmon packing, tendering. So that really, that was the biggest change in the industry, was when they put the quota system in. And not for the better, in my estimation, not for the better, because cut out all kinds of people out of the industry. Not only the fishermen, but the people we bought gear from, the people we bought food from, engines from, built boats with, all of that was gone. When the quota system, just those particular boats that were there at the right time got a quota. Mm-hmm. And that's still in existence today. Mm-hmm. So you don't see anybody building new boats.
No, you haven't seen any new boats in a long time.
No. There was a big, when they put the quota system in, it was, and they saw that the Arctic trawler worked, that we could produce 2,000 tons of codfish fillets, in a three-month period of three and a half, sometimes 4 months from the time you left, because it was a week from Seattle to the Dutch and a week back again, so you fished 3.5 months. And it took 2 years to get a full, what would you call a full educated crew on the boat so that things went smoothly. And when other people saw this, you know, because they all, you know, the word was that they'll never make it. Well, of course, when we started bringing in these big loads, pretty soon there was a mad run to build factory trawlers. Well, you couldn't build them all in a hurry, so a lot of them bought other hulls and then had new boats built on top of the older boats that they had bought wherever they bought them. So you had a pretty good trip, the fleet. You still have a good fleet up. They're great fishermen, most of these guys. And the industry is going along, but it's there's no crab. And nobody knows why, but you always see everybody always wants to say that it's the fishermen and overfishing. Well, we haven't set a quota. It's set by the government, whether a state and federal. They set the quotas. And we have observers aboard, semi-police, that measure all the crab to make sure, not all, but they'll take samples all the time, measuring the crabs to see that they're legal, 6.5 inches across the back. And they're looking to see if you catch a halibut, then they write it all down, measure it. Because you're not allowed to catch them. And if you do catch them, you're not allowed to eat them. Same with the salmon. If you get a salmon, you can't keep it. After they've measured it, it's dead, but you've got to throw it back. So that changed the whole industry. So that old industry that came out of Ballard all those years ago, we were one big family of people, group people. We all knew each other. We've been together since we were kids. A lot of us, our fathers, had been together before us. So we had a camaraderie, which is no longer. That's gone. And I don't know how, if ever, you'll get that sense of well-being back that we had, because everybody helped everybody. didn't have this continuous.
And everybody lived here.
And
right?
everybody lived
they'd,
here.
They'd
That's
come
right.
back and they'd come right back to Ballard.
Right. And we had, our events and whatever, you know.
We're actually sitting in Pacific Marine Shipyard now, which is where you had the Sea View built.
Right.
Yeah. Very historical place. There's been lots and lots of historic fishermen.
Oh, you better
at
believe
location.
It. And of course, I was a kid. I grew up here in this docks, running these docks, before I ever went fishing. And even when we had the boat, we did all the repair work here on the Pat Fish and Seattle ship when it was in operation over here, after they were through building minesweepers and so on and so forth for the war. So it's we only have two shipyards left here now. We have the Lake Union Shipyard up in the head of the lake up here, and we have this one, and I hope they get the extra property. They need it because there's no place to tie up boats either anymore. So not that much room.
It's changed.
Changed. Everything has changed. I was fishing salmon in Kodiak. I was fishing salmon one year in Kodiak with the natives, a couple of four native guys. And we don't have mosquitoes down here. So then these fellas, all young guys, we were all young guys. So then they said, well, we're going to go over to the mainland off of Kodiak, over on the mainland side, and try. There was a the lake over there. Well, it was. They were going to go up in the lagoon, you know, set the net across the entrance and go up in the lagoon and chase the fish out. Well, there was no fish up there, but it was a big grizzly bear which chased us out. They're not nice. And so that was fun. That was in 1954. I was salmon fishing in. I'm going back and forth now. Things are coming to mind, fishing up there. And the mosquitoes were terrible. Oh, my God. For some strange reasons, mosquitoes don't like me. So these native fellas, they had netting around their head, and they had netting all over themselves. And I'm just standing there, blood running off of me. But I didn't swell up, didn't get anything, and didn't feel it either. So I was lucky. I know when my uncle was, because he was along, when he was up there, we were packing for Halfordy Canning Company in Kodiak. They're long gone. I think they were affiliated with Ocean Beauty maybe all those years ago. But anyway, poor guy, you know, if he had any piece of skin sticking out from under the blanket at night, in the morning was all sort of bad. Mosquitoes had a feast eating on him. Mm-hmm. So I felt badly for him. And you mentioned something when you talked to me about that Tor had told you that a boat had blown up on the East Coast.
Snoopy.
Yeah, from hauling up a torpedo. Well, we hauled up lots of torpedoes out here.
Right up
there's
here.
An ammunition dump right off of Vancouver Island where we fished. And so, you know, it took us a while to figure out you could fish down to 280 fathoms, and then that was as deep as you could go, because then you ran into torpedoes, mines, 50 caliber slugs, every kind of munition you could imagine. And we all had an agreement then that if you got any of that stuff, you took it out deeper and you dropped it. You didn't put it in on the fishing grounds. We did not want to see it back again. Mm-hmm. Nobody got blown up, nobody got hurt, but I'm going to tell you that it was hair-raising every time that torpedo, you didn't know it was in the net till it came on, you put it aboard, and if you could see it outside, you could cut it loose. But once it was in, then you had to figure out how to get it overboard without banging it into something.
And these were munition dump areas after the war.
After the war.
So they just, the government went out.
So it's still there. It's on the chart, I'm sure. So, but we can't fish 200 miles. The other big thing that changed the whole fishery was 200-mile limit. That really screwed things up. So, because we had fished all up and down here, and then this edge here is very, very narrow. So when you got out to 200 fathoms, especially up along Vancouver Island and north, you ran out of ground before you got there. So, and then that's why a lot of the guys who had been here, they had to move. Well, and then they saw what we were doing crab fishing, and they all came along. A lot of all my buddies, they all came along.
And so you were fishing before the Magnuson-Stevens Act too.
Oh, of course.
There was all kinds of boats in the water.
Not really. It was no money. You know, I made $4,000 the first year I fished, and I made $4,600 the second year I fished, and that was 12 months a year. Mm. Well, we had 2 weeks off, you could say, a year. 2 weeks. We had a month off. We painted, took 2 weeks and painted the boat in the summer when the weather was nice, and we took 2 weeks to be home for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So Magnus and that, it became, when it became, when the, you know, then it got to be a politics. And politics still rules the roost, no matter what, which is, you know, that's just a continuous fight.
Mm-hmm. What would you say has been your best day at sea? I know you've had a lot of them, so it's probably hard to
best day fishing?
Best day at sea.
Oh.
I'm trying to remember who it was. Rick Reynolds, an episode on Rick Reynolds. I asked him that same question. He says, well, my best day doesn't even involve fish. But that's how he started his
part.
Oh,
is that right?
Yeah.
No. Well, the best time we had was when we all went up here from Ballard. This whole group of people, some you see on the walls, the boats, and what the, you don't see many people. But when we left here and went up there, because then when we, and then in those days, because it was still a small fleet, 14, 15 boats, 12 boats, you know, just a few to start with of the newer boats. And because there was a few, because we were all such close friends, then the wives came up and the kids came up. So the women were up there with us together for those four, my wife fished with me in the summertime for 4 years with having the kids aboard. The youngest one, he had his fifth birthday in a Seawong Pass, and she had made a cake, and we'd been at Kodiak delivering, and so she had gone up to the store and bought some little things for the boy. But that was a fun time. That was a really fun time fishing. Mm-hmm. That was just like you were still in Ballard, but, you know, it was fun. Even though we were fishing, but it wasn't anything, nothing was changed. Just had moved a whole group of people mm-hmm. up north.
All together. What about your worst day?
Probably the worst day was, I don't know. I never lost anybody. I had a couple of guys. My worst day was probably they set two crew up, and they both were right out of jail, prison. I didn't know that. I needed a couple of crew members. It was long lining for codfish, and they set two guys up. You know, they had these teardrops on them, and I didn't know what those teardrops meant. You know, so one of the crew says, "Well, those guys have killed somebody," and I said, "What the heck are you talking about?" I said, that's prison tats or whatever they are. So that was a kind of a shake-up. Because in the night, in that next evening, around 3 in the morning, then one of the guys runs up and says, well, you know, those two guys that came aboard, they're having a knife fight down in the galley. Just what I want to hear, 3 o'clock in the morning. You got to come down and break it up. I didn't have anything at the time. Up in the pilot house. So after that, I always had a baseball bat with me anyway, because we didn't have any guns aboard, although I did catch one guy with a gun aboard. And same, you know, when you're at sea and you catch somebody, you know, you're a day or two away from land, you don't like, you got to take them in, you got to get rid of them, you can't have it, because they are a little dangerous. But those are two of the more unsavory days. Probably the other days, you know, it was the same with the crew, because the crew, who I had the same crew for years, the crew would have their wives and kids come up too, you know. So they were, then it became a family affair, if you will. Mm-hmm. Those were good times. And the bad times are when you ran into guys, druggies, especially in 75, when all the drugs showed up in Dutch Harbor. My goodness gracious. Cocaine. We'd never been involved. I didn't know one thing about drugs when I went fishing, and I didn't know anything about drugs. So we got to Alaska, and all of a sudden in 1975, Dutch Harbor's full of drugs. And I didn't know a thing about it. I didn't learn the hard way, but it was really disappointing to see how many people were using, and these are new people coming into that group of people mm-hmm. who were using drugs. Can't use drugs at sea, you know. That's too dangerous. You're not only yourself, because if you have a problem, you know, you are going to have there's no doctors, you know, and I'm 2-3 days from town. Get a helicopter out there if they can get a hold of them, and you know, they have to, at that time they had to come from Kodiak, the helicopter, come out and take them out, and they didn't like that. I had one, the worst guy I had, we were up by Attu, the westernmost land of America, out in Attu. Maybe Hawaii is a little further, but I don't think so. And I had this guy that was, we had this half-gallon milk cartons. And every morning he filled it up half with sugar and then some kind of Kool-Aid or something he added to set a color. And he's down there drinking this and drinking that. What the hell is going on? And somebody said, well, you know, he's a heroin addict. Well, no, nothing about that. Now I'm what, about 5-6 days from any place to get rid of him. And the cutter came by and stopped. We were fishing out there. So I asked the cutter, you know, I said, I got a guy here who I really would like to send home, and he really would like to go home. And cutter said, no way. We're not taking any of your problems with us out here. We're on our way home, and we're not stopping anywhere. So there's lots of little stories here and there, and everyone, but, you know, I have to say, I love fishing. That was the greatest adventure. And that's what everybody said, you know, it was like the old West.
What did fishing give to you? What did the sea give to you?
Oh, everything. Yeah, I would have stayed and fished down here, except we couldn't, even though we were young guys, we couldn't go 3 days, fill up 100,000 pounds, go home, unload 100,000 pounds, and then leave it another 3 days again. That just wore everybody out. Well, you know, that some guys, they were tough guys. They're nice guys. They didn't have any drugs, those guys. No alcohol. But even they got wore out towards the end. And then then the weather got bad. So then you did get a day or two off when you were in harbor waiting for the weather to come down. So, but fishing was great. It's the finest life ever was as far as for young people. We'd be a boy or girl, didn't make any difference. We had women on board. They worked just as hard as the men. Now, there were certain things they couldn't do, you know, like on deck. But the rest of it, they could do all of that. And I had 8 women, and they had 8 girls aboard. I didn't consider, you know, they were 18, 19, 20 years old, right out of school, high school. And they made so many friends, good friends on the boats, that they're still friends with these young people. Well, not young anymore, but they're still friends, even at age 45 or 65, mm-hmm. Nowadays 65. Nice, and all nice people. So the ones I still see anyway, a lot of them just disappeared. A lot of them, some I would tell them, I could see they weren't gonna make it. They couldn't get over being seasick. And would tell him, you know, you know, you're a hard worker, but this isn't for you. You should go back to school. And so every once in a while, which is really pleasing to me anyway, somebody will walk up, man or woman, and say, I want to thank you for the job that I got the money on to put myself through school. They said, I'm a doctor, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm working in a shipyard, but I learned how to work. And it was the same with the girls, you know. They learned how to work. I had a tough cook, really, Ivor, he was tough. So these girls came aboard when we were leaving. So Ivor said, okay, I want you to wash down the officer's deck, and I want you to clean it up, and I'm gonna come up and take a look at it. 3 girls there. So I don't know how that worked, but they went, he came up there and told them, do it over, it's not clean. Okay, then things were getting tough. Went up again, it's not clean. Well, now they're starting to cry, you know. So after the third time, I think he felt kind of sorry, but it really wasn't clean. The third time, they finally got it where it met his standards. And after that, no problems. They did great. Everybody was having a good time, you know. So
you can build really strong friendships at sea.
Absolutely. Well, where are you going to go? That's the people you talk to every day.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, but at least you could talk to them. In an office, sitting in an office, what do? You can't really go around and talk to somebody when they have a job to do and they're not very close to each other.
Right. Water cooler only.
That's right. And that's kind of sad.
Yeah. What has the sea taken from you?
I'd taken anything. I never lost a man. I've had injuries. People got injured. Worst injury, it wasn't even an injury, but I had a guy that was bipolar, and I had no experience with bipolar people either. And so this guy, one of the guys, comes up from the factory. He said, "There's this guy running down there, and he's got a crowbar in his hand, and he's threatening to kill everybody." So I had to go down, and it was found out he was bipolar. So I got him out of there. I got him up in the pilot house, and I'm calling the doctor here in Ballard. I said, "Get this fellow on here. He's bipolar." I said, "But he threw his pills away, and I don't have any. Can you tell me if anything I have a board here can calm him down?" And the guy said, "Well, you can tie him up and lock him in a room." And I said, "And this is from the doctor." And I said, "Well, geez, that's just not going to work." So I finally managed to get him in his stateroom, but I couldn't get the crowbar away from him. But I kept him in there till we got to town anyway. And then we had to fly him home. Well, the rules up there are that I, being the captain, I'm responsible for that guy till his wheels up on the plane. So I told the snooze, because he had about 5 knives sticking him on his belt. I went up and told the stewardess, "You know, this guy's kind of dangerous, and you got to be a little careful." "Oh, no worries," he said. "We'll take care of him." So, no problems. But I asked him if I could call his mother, and he didn't say it. I said, "I don't have a number," so I called the offices. Can you call his mother and see if she has anything that she can send up? And she told him, "I don't want to see him. I don't want to know anything about him, because he's bipolar, and he was had been giving her such problems his whole life." So that was kind of hard to hear. You know, you don't hear that very often in your life.
Yeah. I think I know the answer already to the next question, but would you change anything?
Would I change anything? No way. Best industry, I told you. Best industry and the most, well, it's changed today just because of the amount of money involved. But in those days, it was the greatest camaraderie amongst a big group of people in Ballard and a big group of people up in Bering Sea, Dutch Harbor. And the families still are friends. You know, all of the fellows that I fished with that were friends of mine, now they're all gone, most of them, you know. But I'm going to be 90 years old this year, so they're all gone. But I still see their kids who are in their 60s, mid-60s, retired. And, so that part of it, you can't, you know, that's just life. That's the only thing that, if I could, I would go back fishing today.
It seems like you have the vigor. I mean, almost 90, but you're pretty.
But the insurance company won't let me go. I'm too old.
Right.
You might fall down. That's what I hear. Wherever you go now to a doctor, you'll run into that pretty soon. First thing they say is don't fall down.
Well, what are you trying to say?
You know,
yeah.
How that works?
Yeah, I do. I do. So. In fact, Bart had something similar to say this morning.
Okay.
He didn't know he was old until he got old.
Well, that's what happens, and it is really strange when you get. I don't feel old. I don't feel old at all. The physical body is not doing what I want it to do all the time, but I don't feel old. You know, but you can't get a job when you're 90 years old or close to 90 years old. The people that hire you have to take on the insurance, mm-hmm. if the insurance companies will ever even insure you, and I don't know if that they will.
Mm-hmm. Any advice for young guys, young men and women?
If they wanted to take a trip just to see how this part of the world works, they should do it. Because there's no, now on these boats they have cell phones and you can call home or all the time. Before we didn't have, so when you were gone for 3 months, you didn't talk home, you know, unless it was an emergency. But no, I think that they should look, they should go and see what it's like. Meet the people. It's a different group of people, but then this is the people they're used to anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't hardly see many young, still some young people come around and get jobs, on, especially on the factory trawlers. So,
Anything else you'd like to share with us?
No, there's lots. I got lots to talk about for years. I could talk for a long, long, long time. But there's a few high points and how much I loved the industry. It was fantastic. And the people that were in it, not you know, all the people that you became associated with as time went on, you know, the people in the engine companies that you talked to about things, problems with the engines, the net companies, because we get different nets. Not only in America, but in Europe and Asia, you know, you met people from all over the world as this industry expanded.
This, and we're sitting in a building that carries a lot of that history. Yeah. It just happens that the conference room we sat down in, a picture of your father is hanging 4 feet away from us.
Yeah, that's right. He was the original board member on here when they bought this property and put it into it was a co-op in those days. For the fleet, because they needed a place that they could come up. Martha did who was the secretary and the bookkeeper. She did their books for them, did their taxes for them.
Wasn't there like 400 and something shares? Like period. Yeah, it was just a small amount.
Right.
And it was all those that same family you're talking about down here.
Yeah.
Were the ones that got.
But now, because of the time, a lot of the children, if they didn't have boys, the girls didn't want to be involved, they sold their shares, which was okay, you know, that's just business. So you have new people now with shares, and you have some people, you're allowed to own 4 shares now. Before, you're only allowed to own 1, so the number of owners is down, which is, you know, the shipyard has done really well this last years. Since the crab fishing started, they've done extremely well.
And they're good about capturing history. Pacific Fisherman Inc. is a book that John Douglas Dixon did with Fred Pointer.
Yep.
And it's got every boat. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but it sure looks like he's got every boat that they built at this shipyard. And some history on it.
Oh, yeah. No,
very cool book.
They're all here. It's a good book.
You go out into the shipyard, and here in Ballard, as business has come and gone over the last 50, 60 years, these guys have gotten their signs.
Oh, yeah.
Like when the sign comes down from the building that's closing, and they're all hanging up out here.
That's
and
right.
Some of the signs out there are historical.
Oh, yeah. Well, we grab everyone. Well, Doug grabs everyone he can get a hold of. And it is historical.
Yeah.
Except we're in a time period where this is really old now, you know.
I like old.
Yeah, well, so do I. But this is old time stuff. And you know, we used to have a coffee shop here. We used to have a coffee shop here downstairs. It used to be a store here where you could buy. We bought it because it was a co-op, so you bought your groceries here, and you bought your gear here, because it wasn't like today where they buy $1 million worth of gear before they leave. You know, then because here you bought what for a trip on a trip by trip basis, and you watched your pennies. Just because of what little money there was in those days, old days, but it's interesting when the crabs really got going. Surprising how many people came back that had left the industry, whose dad had been in the industry and they had been in the industry, but they were older than me, probably 4 or 5 years older than me. They were old enough. But because they were fishing, they didn't have to go into war because they were producing food. But still, when the war was over then, the prices dropped. They all left. About 90% of them left. There's hardly any young guys here. I was the youngest guy for years here. And now I'm getting to be one of the oldest.
it's a good term, though.
Oh, yeah. Still going.
Any final thoughts?
No, I appreciate it. Being able to say a little bit, I'm sure I rambled on a little too much and skipped around too much.
I got several hours if you want to keep going.
I have to go. The boss is still the boss. So
you bet.
I have to go shopping for her. So.
All right, Conrad, I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, I hope it makes some sense.
It's capturing the history.
Well, it is history, and it was great to be a part of it, you know, and it's great that we have some of the younger people who are not that young now, they're 65, but at least they were here for part of the time when times were really tough, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. But it's an interesting industry. The crab has disappeared. They blame the fishermen, but it's not that. It's and the other thing is they never go down into deep. I've never heard them do a research tour down in 280 to 300 fathoms. We fished Opelia, 280 fathoms up off of St. Paul, St. George. No one had ever been down there before. There was all kinds of stuff down there. So you don't know whether they could be on the Russian side now for all we know. The crab, the halibut, pollock, everything could be on the Russian side. You never know how they're traveling looking for feed all the time. Anyway, I got to get going. Appreciate the time.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
You bet. You take care.
All right, you too.
Thanks for listening to Galley Stories. We hope you like what the net brought in. Please leave us a review on iTunes, whether you like it or not. We're not fishing for compliments. Look us up on Facebook and Twitter, too, and reach out to us at galleystories@gmail.com.